Institute for Technological Innovation with the GIPS School of Enterprise, because again, if you don't have an understanding between technology and enterprise, this innovation that we are talking about means nothing. We have put that in the document. Maybe it doesn't come very, very clear in the presentation. And again, maybe, Chair, one of the things we don't want to keep coming to the portfolio committee, but on all of these grand challenges and on...
Thank you very much, Chair. And good morning, honorable members. I would just take you through the presentation and then later I would ask for the CFO to just take you through some of the expenditure information, and then and also Dr. Mayeki would come in giving further explanations to the presentation. Just in terms of the content of the presentation and the structure, we've covered the vision and the background to the MRLF, the performance information, and audit report. In respect of the vision for the MRLF, the department's vision is the same as that of the MRLF. Basically because the MRLF, the accounting authority, is still the accounting officer of the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. We do not have a separate board for the MRLF, as members might be aware, unlike the SA Tourism, as they came with their chairperson yesterday of the board of SA Tourism. I'll then also just take you through then the actual mission. The vision is a prosperous and equitable society living in harmony with our natural resources. And the mission is that of leading sustainable development of our environment for a better life for all through promoting conservation and sustainable utilization of our natural resources and enhancing economic growth, promoting a global sustainable development agenda and transformation of the fishing industry. The MRLF and MCM, in terms of the DEET programs, it is program 3 of DEET, and in essence then they spend on that basis of that program allocation. And the purpose of Program 3 is to promote the development and management of South Africa's marine and coastal environments in a way that ensures sustainability of the marine resources while maximizing economic opportunities. The Marine Living Resources Fund was established in terms of Section 10 of the Marine Living Resources Act of 1998. And it is supposed to be a Schedule 3A public entity, whilst we still have the misnomer of it not having a separate board. And members have been taken through that previously at previous briefings, but we can still discuss it further. The MRLF therefore covers the operational costs of 5 sub-programs or 5 chief directorates. The research component and resource use component, and then enforcement component, which is MCF, and then integrated coastal management, which is the ICM, and the Office of the Chief Financial Officer, including administration. Personnel is paid out from the Department Program 1 administration. In terms of achievements, in respect of what we had in the business plan of the Marine Living Resources Fund, we have concluded the long-term fishing rights that were granted in 20 fisheries sectors after the whole appeals process. This is now the final figure in terms of what was achieved in the 2067 financial year. average interest in terms of the transformation of the sector, we had achieved 59% BEE compliance in December 2006. We've drafted policies on subsistence and small-scale fisheries that were published during that financial year, which were then progressed. There was further progress in the current financial year, and drafted policy on the management of seabirds and shorebirds. In terms of the integrated coastal management, we published the integrated coastal management bill, which is now being dealt with in Parliament. The marine aquaculture policy was also published in that financial year, and three marine protected areas were declared, that Alwar Shoal, Diwop, and Ogama. And we've drafted policies for broad-based whale watching and white shark cage diving. The terms of reference for the land-based resources on marine pollution were also issued in that financial year. And in respect of the sub-program on monitoring, control, and surveillance, we've improved monitoring in terms of our capacity through the implementation of the new vessels, and we've installed the new vessel monitoring system, and we've had an effective deployment of the APV system, and we've taken on board in terms of our agreement with the cross-border and in respect of the SADC protocol, and we've implemented enforcement agreements through that cooperation. In terms of what we've achieved in the area of financial management through the Office of the Chief Financial Officer, we implemented an MRLF turnaround strategy for the weaknesses that were identified in the Auditor General's report and SCOPA, and through the financial management system, which is Oracle-based, and MAST system for the management information system. The draft cost recovery model was developed, and we've engaged further with National Treasury in that regard. They have indicated that it is not quite advisable that we focus on cost recovery because of issues of affordability of the fishing industry, but we can get into the details of that if members want us to talk to that during the discussion today. In respect of accounting policies, as you might be aware, with the MRLF, we did not quite have our controls were not quite in place at the previous time that we came to the committee, and we've tried to make sure that those controls and accounting practices are in line with international accounting standards. In respect of the audit, Auditor General's opinion, we have received a qualified audit opinion, bearing in mind that we're coming from a disclaimer for the years 2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006. And we hope that we can move towards achieving an unqualified audit in 2007-08. And without wanting the members to think that we're not worried about the issue of qualified audit, we're quite taking that very seriously. And our turnaround strategy is supposed to take us to a more improved audit report. And now I'm just going to move on into giving you some comparisons in respect of what happened in the previous audit report, which was 2005-06, and in comparison with what we got in 2006-07 financial year. We have, in terms of our annual report, we think we have tried to implement systems for governing the fund. In respect of the previous next slide, thanks. In respect of the previous audit report, we had 20 qualifications, and the Auditor General decided not to express an opinion. And in this current audit report, we have 5 qualifications. So we moved from 20 to 5 qualifications, and the Auditor General then expressed an opinion, which is still quite not what we want to be. We want to have a qualified and an unqualified audit report. In respect of how we have improved, we have improved financial management that has led to the clearing of significant disclaimers relating to the revenue and debtors and the disposal of assets. And I would just demonstrate that when I go forward in terms of the next slide. A correct application of the international standards of accounting. We've continued to improve governance issues with a focus on due diligence, strengthening the control environment and improving coordination, communication and monitoring. A special attention has been given to the strengthening of the financial accounting skills and capacity of the entity. In that year we lost the CFO, and we've struggled to actually fill in the CFO position, and we have been quite prescriptive wanting to have a chartered accountant. And I think because of the negative publicity that the MRLF has, we don't get accountants. We even went into a process of headhunting, and when we thought we had got somebody to come in, the person then was snatched by Woolworths, and unfortunately she did not start. But in the end, we appointed the CFO that's next to me, Mr. Mohammed, to be the CFO from this new financial year. So we were working without a CFO again in the last financial year. Not because we had liked to and would like to have more accountants, because accrual accounting is different from cash-based accounting, and it's something that's very tricky and that we've been grappling with in the MRLF, in the management of the MRLF. Getting to then a tabular presentation of what we had achieved, or what sort of improvements we think we had in the last financial year, in the financial year that we're reporting on, compared to the previous one where we had a disclaimer. In the area of plant and equipment and property, we had two qualifications around non-compliance with GAAP, which is the standards for accounting, and the depreciation that was overstated in terms of our equipment, and that was involving R1 million loss, or that was questionable in respect of that, those two items. And we then, in this report that we are tabling to the members, we have an overstatement of the Florent Mkhize, and therefore from two qualifications we've moved to one qualification. In the area of revenue, trade and other receivables, debtors could not be verified, revenue could not be confirmed. We had about 9 qualifications in this area, you can see in the report also. And in this current report that we are tabling to you now, we have got no qualification in this area, and that involved about over R108 million. So these are the areas where we've sort of put a handle and tried to resolve problems within the MRLF. Expenses, trade, and other payments. We had incorrect allocations of vessel operating costs, incorrect allocation on commissions that were paid, and supplier statements that were not provided. And we've got one qualification still in the area of supplier reconciliations that were overstated. And the amount that was involved in the year before the one that we are reporting on, just on reconciliations, was R17 million, and the one that we have been qualified on the basis of involves R1 million. And this relates to also the issues around National Treasury. You know, when we were building the new vessels, members, you might just be aware that we were getting money from Treasury as we were building, and there was some money that was not used for building the vessels, which had to then be used on operations around 2004-05 financial year, and we got approval to use some of the money And I think we then, as the entity, continued to spend the money without the treasury approval. Hence, we have those kinds of qualifications. Contractual commitments that could not be verified, we have none in this report. We had one qualification in the previous year. Inventories that were not disclosed. At the time, we did not, in this year, we don't have a qualification. We had one qualification in that financial year previously. Pay as you earn, the employees' tax deductions, no exemption certificates from labor brokers were in place at the time, and that could not be determined in terms of the value. That was a loss. And in essence, this has been cleaned out in the current financial statements. And cash flow statements, again, we had one qualification in that regard, and we don't have a qualification in this report in that area as we are presenting today. Opening balances, we still have a problem here around the accuracy and completeness of our opening balances, and that we still have a qualification in this regard. And government grants, as I already indicated, that we had deferred income. Now we have two qualifications in that respect, which amount to 24 million from an amount of 52 million that I indicated earlier on that was not spent on vessels. 28 million was approved by National Treasury for expenditure, and then 24 million we did not have an approval, and we are now currently working on that approval ex post facto as we speak. And that comes back from 2004-05. So it seems the ills of the past will still creep in as the Auditor General looks at our books as the MRLF until we find ways of closing the old problems. We are still going to have qualifications in that regard, it seems. And I just want to stress to members that as a department, we've taken, the DG was spending, I would say, 60% or 80% of, between 60 and 80% of his head time in the last two financial years in MCM and understanding issues both from the audit committee and meeting with the executive team at MCM and the financial management team to understand deeper and deeper the problems, and every time there is something new that we have not been aware of and which we have to then find ways of getting bad papers from 3-4 years ago, and in some of them we don't have backup documentation and we can't recreate that backup documentation, which in a sense is still putting us under a qualification. But we now have taken extraordinary measures. We've got the project steering committee, which we call it Let's Fix It, and that meets weekly, and the DG would meet once a month with that committee just to understand progress. I would continue in my acting capacity to do that. The temporary staff that we appointed to assist in problematic areas, particularly around creditor reconciliation, balance sheet accounts reconciliations, and fixed assets. And we have an accounting firm that we also negotiated an agreement with so that we are able to finalize our reconciliations for this for this ending financial year, so that we have an unqualified report when we come back to the committee. Lastly, we also, as I indicated earlier, we've appointed Salim to be our chief financial officer starting this month, and we hope that she will be getting the support that she needs also from the other technical people in the area of accrual accounting. I would also just want to indicate that while...
Yes,
Salim.
I thought it was she.
No, we had a she before that we offered the position to, and that she did not accept. Okay. And whilst then I'm saying we tightening measures, this takes us to the issue of asset verification process that we've commenced and we've put in place procedures for disposal of assets, which relates also to the issue that you've seen and in the media around the Eagle Star disposal. And we have a disposal committee that has got that responsibility now going forward in managing how we best deal with the issue of depreciating assets and also selling of assets for the MRLF. Dr. Maek, so we'll give you some more information around the issue of the Eagle Star so that the members are quite aware with what has been done. We have an ongoing training of staff so that they are more competent in dealing with the new financial systems that have been implemented, both Oracle financial system as well as MAST system. There is a training that also we've scheduled with SAMDI for financial management to non-financial trained managers. So Dr. Maegisa will just take us through the issue of this Eagle Star and also make reference to the Smith-Amanda report and the report that we got after we submitted a request for an inquiry to the Scorpion, which we can also give the chair and maybe one or two members a copy of. I would first want to give Salim an opportunity to just talk to the finances in terms of what was allocated in the previous financial year, and then thereafter Dr. Maek.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, we had the MLRF budget. I don't know if they have it on the slide here now. Unfortunately, they didn't bring it through, but I'll just read through the revenue and expenditure budgets for 2005-06. You'll see in the annual report that the previous financial year we had a 210 million rand revenue budget, and our expenditure was 275 million rand, resulting in a deficit of 65 million rand. And in the 2006-07 financial year, this current year that we're reporting on, there was a revenue collection of 346 million rand. So much more than what was anticipated. Our expenditure came to about 280 million rand. So therefore, we had a surplus of 66 million rand in the 2006-07 year. That is much to do with the correct application of international accounting standards as well, as opposed to previous years that wasn't correctly applied. So therefore, the figures were skewed, in other words, in the previous financial years. As the acting DG has indicated, that there was also this issue about government grants. And the 54 million rand that we did not get an approval for, this is to do with the fact that international accounting standards wasn't applied to the treatment of government grants, which we did this time. So it shows the correct figures in place in this annual report. We've also, you'll notice in the annual report, there's also the section in the financial statements with regards to prior year errors and adjustments that was made. It's in full detail in the annual report in terms of what type of adjustments we made because of applying proper international accounting standards. Furthermore, within this surplus of 66 million rand, we also had accruals coming through from previous years, where normally in a cash-based accounting environment, for a public or for a government department or a provincial national department, they would cut off the year as whatever happened in the previous year stays in the previous year. And you go to the next year, then you don't actually have accounts payable or debtors that rolls over to the following year. Whereas we are Schedule 3, a public entity, and of course we work on accrual basis of accounting. Therefore, we had to now account suddenly for accounts payable after 3 years of disclaimed audit where no accounts payable has been accounted for, which made our accruals a huge amount. We had accruals, if you see in the annual report, you'll see accruals to the value of 54 million rand in our balance sheet that we had to now pay suppliers from previous years. We had to reconcile and do the calculation over. So this surplus, we covered the 54 million in accruals. Then we also have deferred income. As I said, we utilized international accounting standards. In fact, it is IAS 20 which governs the way you need to account for government grants. even if your government grant is from a international government, it is still seen as a government grant. And what that basically means is that you take your assets and you take the amount that you've received for that government grant and net it off against that asset, the value of the asset, which means that you will be the value of the asset will be valued at 1 rand. However, you still need to pay the supplier, of course. Right? So if you did not pay the supplier within that financial year, then what we refer to in accounting terms as we create deferred income. And that deferred income we need to keep in a separate account. And what I've created is a bank account where it's an earmarked funding bank account. Now, previously the fund never really had a reconciliation on earmarked funding. So you understand that how it came about that money was spent in previous financial years, thinking that the fund was actually afloat with money, but it was all in one bank account. So your operational bank account would be utilized for earmarked funding would come in there, operational fund money would come in there, and it would all be mixed and utilized for operational purposes, of course. Whereas in actual practice, you're supposed to put it in separate bank accounts, as we did now. We've got a separate earmarked funding bank account, we've got a separate donor funding bank account, and then a separate operational, MRF operational bank account. In fact, we went the way of having a revenue bank account and an expenditure bank account for better control, you know. But we've got the deferred income amount in our balance sheet as well, which is the value of 17 million rand. So basically it's 71 million rand that we now have to count for from the past. And we had a surplus of 66 million rand, luckily. So therefore, our cash deficit wasn't so grave. Our cash deficit, if you look at it from what you'll see in the financial statements, is a 66 million rand surplus. However, if you look at the cash flow statement, you will notice that, of course, we need to account for that cash, and there's 5 million rand that's basically a deficit for us. Our 07-08 financial year, we've got a revenue and expenditure budget. Of course, as a public entity, we're not allowed to budget for a surplus or for a profit. We can never use the word profit. I come from the private sector, so it's a bit difficult to come and talk about surplus and deficit. But nevertheless, we now need to talk about surplus and deficit, and there's no surplus and deficit in our budgeting process. But our budgeting process has been concluded, as we said earlier, and that is at 301.2 million rand for the 07-08 financial year. And in the 08-09 financial year, we have got a budget, a revenue and expenditure budget of 319 million rand. Now, you'll notice it's going up progressively. The reason for that is that we've clearly got a commitment from National Treasury in terms of assisting us in terms of lessening the burden on the fishing industry when it comes to them having to pay levies, because the view is taken that they're already taxpayers in this country. So therefore, overburdening them by increasing levies is not the way that National Treasury and the Minister of Finance want to go. We've already explored the cost recovery module, and it basically came down to about, in real terms, it would have meant if we had to increase levies according to our cost recovery basis, it would mean that we would have got the extra 40 million rand. If you look at our financial statements, you will notice that we received about 16 million rand in terms of levies from the industry. Right? So, if we had to implement cost recovery, we would have got this extra 40 million.
Can you hold on 1 second? Let me just check something. Have the members got this copy?
It was sent out for tabling. So now we are surprised that you don't have copies. You've read it? Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry,
okay.
Can I got this?
Yeah.
Okay. So, in other words, it would have meant an extra...
Levies within fines.
Levies. No, not fines. Levies. Please. Levies on fish product.
Just, I know there's going to be question time, but just to move along with you, it was just elaborate.
Sure. There's levies set for various sectors. There's 22 fishery sectors, and many of them are leviable at different rates, depending on the value, right? And these levies are charged to rights holders who get a total allowable catch. And on that total allowable catch, they need to now go in and catch. And on a monthly basis, they give us a levy declaration form. applied, and on that levy declaration form, they will declare their levies and pay it. That's not the ideal situation, members, and I need to respond to this. I'm glad the question was asked on levies because it's very important going forward as an accrual accounting entity. Because the current situation is that rights holders give us a levy declaration form after they have caught. Right? Now, we then take that information and punch it into our financial system and recognize that that revenue. But if you look at the pure definition in accounting terms of revenue, you need to match it with the action of producing income. So therefore, that matching concept, to my mind, is not being met here by our current status. What would be ideal is if we rather have a situation where we set out the TAC to the right holder, and then we bill that right holder for the amount of the TAC. So if the TAC is set out at 1,000 kilograms and at 10 rand a kilogram, then that 100,000 rand or 10,000 rand will have to be paid by, will be a debt to the MLRF, basically. And then it will be my team, the revenue team, that would have to, the debtors team that would have to follow up, like any other entity, like Edgar's would send out a statement to you on a monthly basis. So we'd send out the statement and have an age analysis. It makes us very difficult at the moment to have an age analysis on levy income, you know. And the other thing that the Auditor General also really tried to nail us on was basically the fact that they felt that our income wasn't complete. Now, we were able to prove to them that validity and accuracy existed for the 60 million rand, right? Because what we did was we took every levy declaration form. We filed it. It was a huge operation. We had to file it into each right holder's account, and then we drew up a database. And that database related directly to these levy declaration forms, which satisfied them in terms of validity and accuracy. The acting DG did display on that on the graph that we got no qualification whatsoever on trade and other receivables, whereas the previous year that was the most pervasive qualification, 9 qualifications to the value of 108 million rand. What we had to do then was to prove to the Auditor General that those levies are complete. So what we did was we then took the top 10 right holders that paid levies. And if you notice, the top 10 right holders actually pay more than 80% of levies due to the MLRF anyway. So what we did was we did an audit on them. We checked them through our monitoring control and surveillance section, as well as the chief financial officer contacted them. We went to a constant dialogue with them just to make 100% sure that their income that they're giving to us after they've caught their fish is accurate. And going to their factories, making sure that the amounts relate to what they declare to us. So it's a kind of an audit procedure we did on our own. And that was really significant in the Auditor General then deciding that, yes, your revenue is complete, because more than 80% of it. I come from South African Revenue Service, where I worked before, and they had a similar situation with the Auditor General in terms of completeness. But if you notice, not everybody gets audited, of course. And that's a one-year, a yearly declaration by taxpayers. Now, if you declare the taxpayers, less than 10% of the people in this country, taxpayers in this country, get audited. Yet the South African Revenue Service don't get a qualification on completeness, because they have got these systems going of detection on high-value, high-worth individuals. You know? So we took a similar approach here in this. Ours is just much more frequent because it's on a monthly basis that people declare. You know, and we also had to change our accounting policies, and it was a bit of a difficult one because they had to also meet up with the matching concept. And as I said before, there's a clash with regards to the matching concept because of cash basis of accounting and accrual basis. However, we then took the route of going to the accountant general and engaged with the accountant general and the auditor general throughout the process to try and rectify this. We are satisfied that we have rectified it appropriately. As I said, we didn't get any qualification on that, and we're going to maintain that this year as well. In fact, we've already done work during the financial year on the top 10. You know, we see it as a top 10, and that works best for us for revenue. Our main concern now is, as we said before, on assets. And assets is a problem throughout government. When I was at SARS, they got unqualified audit, but the emphasis of matter on assets. And they're the flagship public entity in this country. no public entity had better results than them over the last 5 years. Yes, they still had an issue on assets. So I'm very concerned about assets. We're working to the team. We don't have enough accounting capacity skills in assets especially. It's very pervasive. It changes every month. There's an IA statement where they have one word change maybe. And that is significant to us. It means a lot in terms of how we need to treat it in a financial statement. So the acting DG did allude to us getting further accounting capacity. It is very difficult to because perception is out there from the private industry that they don't want to join government, not realizing that this is actually an entity that runs on a accrual basis where you have a significant opportunity to be able to make a good impact. So thank you very much.
Dr. Mayek is just going to talk on summary and the ethics stuff.
Thank you. Chair, members would have read in the newspapers about the debacle of the Eagle Star, which was a vessel that was supposed to be a very valuable vessel but sold very cheaply. And we thought we would then give members some more background information to this. I would make the following opening statement, Chair, that as far as the Eagle Star is concerned, there were various factors that combined to cause us to get an outcome that we didn't want. The Eagle Star was a fishing vessel that was owned by a company that was called Haupe, which was responsible for a lot of poaching in the South Coast rock lobster. And when they were apprehended, this vessel was confiscated and became, via court order, the property of the National Prosecuting Authority. We then agreed with the National Prosecuting Authority that the vessel be transferred to DIT, and we paid an amount of about 5 million for it to the NPA. The reason we required the vessel was that we were going to procure 4 new patrol vessels, and we wanted to have services of a vessel that would train our fishery control officers so that when the vessels came in stream 2004, 2005, they knew what to do out in the open ocean. So it was a vessel that was kept by the department for a short. The intention was to keep it for a short period to train the fishery control officers, and that we would get rid of the vessel once we got the new 4 patrol vessels. The vessel was already 33 years at the time, and she was considered appropriate, as I've already said, for the task of training. When we started getting the new vessels, then it was decided to sell the vessel. But what is important for me to indicate here is that that time coincided with a time when there were budget problems, there were financial constraints to the fund. And the vessel was costing the department 3,500 rand a day, and it was doing nothing. And it was then decided that we would have to sell the vessel. In other words, we were under pressure to sell the vessel. It had outlived its usefulness and value to the department because we're now beginning to get the 4 new patrol vessels. As I've already indicated, it was costing a lot of money on a daily basis, and the fund was experiencing financial constraints during 2005-2006. She continued to be a liability to the department. Donating her would have been a more viable option than keeping her. And we did try to donate it to Mozambique. Mozambique was not interested. There was little interest in the vessel based on the initial attempts to donate her and then sell her. Unless the prospective buyer had a very specific use for this vessel, which generated a significant revenue stream, the maintenance and operating costs of the vessel would be crippling.
The market for the vessel is therefore extremely narrow, and narrowed even further after the finalization of the various fishing rights allocation. Members would have seen in the Auditor General's report that there was an auction that was cancelled. Teresa should explain that as well. The department doesn't manage vessels. Our vessels are managed by a shipping company called Metamangla. So we asked Metamangla to advise us on how to sell the vessel, and their recommendation was that we should go by a public auction. We then asked them to go ahead and do that, effect that for us, which they did. What they did was to get gold from 5 auction companies. And once that had happened, there was a complaint from an auction house that the process had not been adequately transparent. I then asked our legal division to give advice on this matter. And the legal division said the process that had been followed by Smith Amand, our manager, the managing company, was indeed challengeable. And then the recommendation, or we asked them to cancel the auction. Now, that time when the auction was cancelled was before the fishing rights were allocated. And we thought that by vessels being auctioned at that time, there would be rights holders who might be interested in procuring a fishing vessel. Because it was cancelled, I think it took us about 5 to 6 months to get another auction. And by the time we set that date, the fishing rights had been allocated and interest wasn't what it should have been. We still went ahead and then did that auction, and there were 2 bidders, one bid for 100,000 and another one bid for 300,000, and that was the highest we got on that day. So, that's why Chair was saying there were a number of things that combined together to give us an outcome that we didn't want. The vessel, Chair, perhaps most important, was that her age, it was now about 37 years old, and her maintenance costs were very high, and she was really past her working life as a vessel that we could use. Then, Chair, lastly, there was the issue of the fact that there was fuel in the vessel worth 250,000 rand. It is correct, there was that fuel, Chair. And the advice we got from Smith Amanda was that the vessel should be sold full stop, which means together with the bunkers of fuel it had. The expectation at that time was that having the fuel in the vessel would actually lift the price of the vessel. Unfortunately, this didn't happen. In addition, taking the fuel out would also have cost money. Cleaning it would, or I don't know what the correct word is, but I'll call it cleaning it, to make sure that it could be used in another vessel, would have taken money. So we agreed with Smith Amanda that the vessel would be sold foodstuffs. I'll stop there, but I'll take questions if there are, Chair.
Okay, just in closing in this regard, Chair and Honourable Members, in the annual report itself, the facts are outlined, as Dr. Marix has indicated, that firstly, the cancellation itself of the vessel of the scheduled auction, which was in August 16, when we rescheduled it to the 14th of November, the vessel itself, Eagle Star, cost the department 519 just to maintain it, was doing nothing, and in fact, over and above that, we had a wasteful expenditure that was in cared just on the cancellation of the auction itself, which was 39,961. So the Auditor General has lifted this issue, and Again, I mean, this is something that we work on advice, and we subsequently then the DG approved that we appoint an external investigator, which was PricewaterhouseCoopers, to do an assessment whether there was corruption possibly in the process of selling the vessel. And the report indicated some level of irregularity, but there was nothing that was going to be that could be materially of significance if we followed through a process of trying to punish the CFO per se. And the CFO resigned also at the time. So the DG during last year appointed the external investigator. That report then was sent to National Treasury. National Treasury advised that we then have to get a forensic investigation. And then we also asked for advice as to exactly who should we use for that. And they advised us to then approach the Scorpions. So we then wrote to the Scorpions, and the Scorpions, we also sent the report to the Scorpions. And the response from the Scorpions, I mean, we wrote a letter to them in February last year. We only got it later on, towards in the middle of the year. They were saying that PricewaterhouseCoopers investigated the matter within the questions raised by Parliament and found nothing irregular. Having considered the matter carefully, we have decided not to investigate the matter unless further information is put forward. And we also then subsequently informed Treasury about that, and these letters are the ones that I just gave to the chair to indicate that we did not have, we could not do further investigations in this regard, also on advice from the Scorpions or the National Prosecuting Authority. So we took the matter very seriously ourselves as an organization, just to make sure that if there was an underhand in the process, we then deal with the individual accordingly, but we did not get to do much about it as per the advice, and also the fact that also the chief financial officer then resigned during that period. Thank you, members.
I've noted during that moment, and maybe before we go into that, I just wanted to sort out clarity in terms of trading in the vessel industry. I'm from the high veld where we don't have any seas nor a river. Tell me, what would have been the trading value of that vessel in lieu of buying another vessel if you were to do that, like in the car industry? You normally trade it in and get another one, and then whoever is building that particular vessel for you perhaps might modify it for a certain customer who's seeking something along those particular lines. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to answer that, at the time, Mr. Manla did indicate because of the age of the vessel and what you need to do to bring it back to cloth, because a certain cloth you're supposed to have to utilize it for purposes that you want to use for other than training. And that would have cost so much that the value of the vessels is in effect 1 rand. There is no value. The useful life has been used already. So, and then you'd have to pay as well to get it to a certain cloth. Yeah, it's not insurable as well. That's the other point my colleague just said. It wasn't insurable at the time. So.
Okay, so we'll give an opportunity to members for questions. I've noted Ntate Mokoena, Agarus, in that order. Thank you.
Yeah. Right. Insurability at that time. But historically, that vessel was insured. So when you insure a scrap, you insure the vessel with an asset where it is at its prime. Now, if you buy a car now, it's like, and then 3, 4, 5 years time, I've not had a situation where the insurance comes and says, no, we're not going to insurance, because you've got a track record of insurance. Now, the question is, how long have we kept this ship? I think I was mentioned of 33 years or something like that. 37 years. Now, what happened? Does insurance depreciate? Because I should imagine when we insure, and of course I'm glad that now the CAs are here, if we pick up a jalopy escort call using township parlance, and go to the insurance company and say, have an old model, you have to insure, they walk away. But if at the time you purchase it, it's brand new, you're insuring it and have the premiums, they don't walk away. Now, what happened to the integrity of the insurance estate? That's number one. Number two, I understand the problems of... I don't buy this book very story. I understand the problems that we encountered by the department in trying to dispose of this asset. And I don't know who was responsible at that time for taking decisions to say, the agent of sourcing this thing, and have the auction for it, et cetera, et cetera. And we know some of those problems we foresee. And finally, there is an upset price. That's what it's called, where I will go to auction. If you take a Rolls Royce and want to dispose of it, say, my old man, 98, I don't want to this car, auction up, please, sell it. You do put an auction, I put it on the number. You do say, I will not accept anything below this figure. And that is called an upset figure. Now, I want to know, because you can't buy the restaurant for 200, that's ridiculous. Now, that's why the person, the seller, will instruct the auctioneer to say, this is my upset price. If somebody comes up with 10,000, then forget it. So, the auctioneer doesn't go there and come up and say, gee, I've sold a piece of the car for 250 rand. So, what was the upset price? And if it was not set up, why was it not set up? So the perception must be created that they are underhand dealing, no matter how clean it could be. But the fact that the Scorpions didn't see anything wrong with PwC didn't see anything wrong doesn't mean that there was no underhand dealing. And to remove that perception, because you see, Scorpa is going to raise this question. Now we as a control committee do not go to Scorpa and be told that Scorpa what would otherwise have been obvious, that we as a control committee in excellent oversight, what did you do? But I'm happy overall about the fact that at least conscious effort was made by MLRS to try and handle this thing in a reasonably transparent manner, but want to ensure that there are no nuances of doubt that are surrounding this thing, you see. So some of the obvious questions are, I'm not going to get to say, but these are just the obvious questions that we want to ask and to try and ensure that there is
a degree
of veracity. Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for that presentation. I think it's fair to say that the situation has improved significantly over the last few years, and I wish the new CFO all the best. Thank you for illuminating a lot of their the procedures that are either have been newly instigated or the ones that you intend to. I think a lot of thought has gone into those. One of my major questions, but just with regards to billing in advance, I mean, I think it makes excellent accounting sense to create the debtor. Is it your view then that the correction which may come if they don't catch? So to give an example, in the abalone, the recent 75-ton abalone, that amount wasn't exploited in the required time. I'm talking about this last season. The minister came in and said 75 tons, and if you had been using that accounting system, that 75 tons would not have been realized anyway. And if that's not a bad example, then there might have to be other examples. Okay. So I'm sure that is a relatively minor thing, but it means that presumably there is another transaction where some debtors, in fact, would have their debt reduced, or I don't know, you can't run off a bad debt, I guess. Okay, you will. Yeah. That's a minor thing that just I was curious about, but thank you. I like the system. I think that makes complete sense.
With regards to, okay, so Marine Living Resources Fund has to do a lot of things, and particularly it also has to spend money. And I can understand why the cost recovery system actually doesn't work. And one is there's an economic side to it, where, as you say, you can burden the fishing industry to such an extent that, in fact, they may not become viable. Mm-hmm. And two, the other thing is that we must always remember that fish as a foodstuff is important protein for South Africa, mm-hmm. and it's one of the cheaper forms, you know. So it actually has implications for calorific intake by ordinary South Africans. So that's on the one hand. On the second hand, of course, could you ever fully recover the cost? Because we're working here with an improved accounting system that's ultimately a human accounting system. And sorry to get terribly environmental, but you actually can't measure the true cost of what you're protecting using the Marine Living Resources Fund. Because the value of enforcement and compliance and protecting the resources is runs into possibly trillions, actually, quite frankly. And there is no acceptable way of doing environmental accounting, and perhaps that's a century away. I remember certainly one of the world's top environmental economists, De Costa, valued the cost of services from the ecosystems on a very rudimentary model at I think it was round about 33 times the cost of the world economy. So you can't do it. So drawing lines are become somewhat arbitrary. Having said all, I guess where I'm going with that is that you only have so many revenue streams, and that is an acceptable thing. I just want to question a few of them. Are you, I know it was mooted last year and I haven't followed it up, are you charging industry for science as an extra levy? Okay? Because I know that was something interesting, and I'm glad you aren't, from the shaking of your head, because once again, it's effectively a levy, quite frankly. You can't hide it. Two is, and this is something that I discovered last year, now accepting the problems with creating revenues. There's certain revenues which you can easily budget for, like you know exactly what total allowable catch is going to be, and you can attach a fee per kilogram, and that is predictable to an excellent degree, because in fact in almost practically every fishery it will be caught. And then, of course, there will be a certain amount of fines and all of those kind of things might be harder to budget for. The issue which has always bugged me, I'm not sure how you get around it, it certainly remains the view of a lot of people in industry that the proceeds from the sale of illegal, of court stuff, the abalone stuff, is a perverse incentive, actually. To the department, and you know, not that I would suggest that this is actually done for that reason. I think the suggestion would be too horrible to even contemplate. But I mean, the obvious mechanics of it is that you know, need money, let a abalone poacher walk off the water, catch him, then auction the abalone, and then create a revenue stream for yourself. Because, as we all know, once an abalone leaves the water, actually, you can't return it. Mm. I mean, someone has to realize some value out of it, and I guess I would rather the state realize value out of it than some guy, you know, working in the Far East. So, but it is a perverse incentive, and I get the feeling that you've almost been forced into a situation of a perverse incentive. If your comments on that and the sustainability of that, I mean, I guess, if all of those confiscations that result in auctioned funds and then a revenue stream simultaneously result in convictions of abalone poachers, then of course the situation is somewhat better. But that doesn't always work out anyway. And of course, sometimes abalone is found in rocks and also, you know, found abandoned. So that was that question which bothers me terribly. The second issue is a more philosophical issue, and I said it 2 weeks ago, and I'll say it again. Enforcement along our coastline is a major problem. I'm sure the department themselves will be the first to acknowledge it. There's just not enough of it being done, despite the goodwill of your fisheries officers, who by and large are very good at what they do, but don't have the resources to do it. So, and this is more an acting DG question than anything else, but I mean, the question has to arise. I realize that this Living Resources Fund has had to turn itself around in order to probably improve confidence from a Treasury point of view, because Treasury is not going to sink money into this if they don't think you're using it well. I suspect you're about to turn the corner on that, I hope so. But at the same time, if my model of you can't use full cost recovery, and where do you draw the line if you attempt to, because of the true value of ecosystem, is true, then the point is you have an obligation to have a revenue stream, but you can't actually fully cost, you actually can't fully pay for your own operational activities using. I mean, it's a lovely idea, but you can't. So the question then is, and I'm going to go to my final point, sorry for being long-winded, but I mean, I haven't had opportunity to talk to you for a long time about this, is that at the end of the day, marine and coastal management needs a significant and annual cash injection from the Treasury. It's the only way you can actually do your job, because you cannot enforce the coastline using that meager amount. Then, of course, and it's a similar argument I think I used yesterday with in both SA Tourism and Dalla Yet, the CFO's got his role is to manage the accounting of it, and whether, you know, money comes in and out and spends, we all want it to be spent correctly. From a strategic point of view, which is arguably the CFO's role plus the DG plus the DDG's role and the minister, looking at long-term sustainability of the fund is obviously very important, because at what point, and this is where, and does this exist, and if it doesn't, then it should be done. Firstly, is there a wish list of what it would cost to really guard our coastline? I mean, does that figure even exist in a strategic paper in any way? The right amount of boats, the right size of boats, the right number of fisheries inspectors, the right number of people with legal skills, and all of those things, whatever, this big figure. And then how big does that differ from what you guys can do in a year? And then added to that fact is, how do you merge those two figures to the extent where you say, if we don't fix enforcement along the case, and so I'm assuming that you would agree with me then, despite all the goodwill of the MCM, it's a problem. I mean, abalone poaching is a problem, and West Coast rock lobster is a problem, and who knows what happens in our deep seas anyway, because there are other problems there. So at what point do our fish stocks become undermined, which then affects the total arable catch, which affects the revenue streams into the Marine Living Resources Fund, and creates a circle where, in fact, you actually don't have, you have less income, a worse off resource, and you actually have nothing to protect anymore. So I'm talking here about strategic vision beyond the CFO's role, really, to look after the money on a year-to-year basis and possibly over a medium-term expenditure. Because, I mean, I would think that study, from your very limited resources anyway, was actually very important, because, and you know, that could be outsourced to clever people at university. But surely from the point of view of motivation, that needs to be done. And actually, for once, and this is for once in South Africa, we need to be able to go to central government and say, we cannot commodify the environment to an extent where we expect the environment to pay for itself. And you could use the same argument for sand parks as well, but I think the problems in the coastal management are far more. I would hope that there are answers to this, and that some kind of strategic plan can be done, but arguing for increased money in order to protect a resource to to thus protect livelihood, to protect biodiversity, which offer free ecosystem services to us as South Africans and the world, is an important amount of money. And it's not like you guys don't spend your money. You know, you're not a department that comes back and says you've underspent. So, you know, you should be a good target for money to be spent. So, those are sort of my broad comments, and then my last specific comment is, you guys presumably confiscate a fair amount of equipment in a year. I mean, I don't know what it is. But you do confiscate super ducks every now and again. And I know that there's a process which is a police process and a prosecutorial process which is difficult. And I've reviewed some of the laws as well. And, you know, I mean, it's quite possible that proceeds of crime can just be destroyed as well. And that no one realizes that value. Having, notwithstanding the Eagle Star and the problems that were created out of a similar issue, but the Eagle Star was also quite a unique vessel, and I accept that there were timing issues. But there are presumably there are possibilities of accumulating increased goods. And I guess you will say, well, that doesn't solve the problem entirely because you still have to pay for operational costs of those goods anyway. But if I could have your comments on those, because it does seem like another way of obviously improving the coastline. And then the last sub-point, and sorry, Chair, I don't think I'll have another round after this, is that, and I said it last week as well, and I got a very generic answer from it, and I'm not sure if anyone is really engaging with it. Taking into account that operational things are expensive, and taking into account the goodwill of people along our coastline, and there are many of them who want to protect the resource, surely there are opportunities for us to increasingly capacitate our honorary fishery officers. I mean, they exist, you don't have to pay them a salary, and granted they don't have to work every day, but they can. And, you know, I've been engaging with one particular group who, from what they tell me, appear very successful and engaged, and their enthusiasm is infectious. So, you know, can't we create a better model of actually going out and setting these up, improving consultation with them, where possible resourcing them, because you don't have to give them salaries, so super ducks and so on, just to improve the system. I'd appreciate your comments on it. Thank you for indulging me, Chair.
Mantuli, and then Judy Chama.
Thank you. My apology for being late. I didn't get that presentation. But in the issue, on the issue of the Eagle Star, now I had no interest. That is no bother. The firstly, Chetterson to say the Eagle Star was bought at 33 years. Then at 37 years, you were panicking to say it's old enough, it can't do the duties that you were expecting. In spite that there were four vessels in the pipeline. And firstly, you see, when you buy a car, a used car, maybe you look at 5 years, not beyond 10 years. So, if you can maybe give that clarity as to say, when it comes to vessels, which years are preferable? Then the planning, acting DG, the planning to say, I think you can't plan to have four vessels overnight. And you can't plan to buy another vessel overnight. The planning, I don't get the logic how it was planned. And Comrade Mugwena covered me with those terminologies because now I was going to ask which he didn't have that fixed amount. If nobody comes and 10 rand is the 10 verse. If no money got 20 rand, you got 50 rand, you got 50 rand, they told you the to me, I don't get the logic. The vessel that has got, if you got 250,000 being sold at 300,000, hi, you are lucky, guys. You are lucky, guys. You are lucky, guys. Nimsula. Mna, Benizia will try for a coup. Tinsa would do it. Tinsa Nagom. What? You see, at a glance, this is not talking. Not talking, and you find which somebody somewhere was just careless. There is nothing that is so bad, but it was just carelessness. But this carelessness, you see, it makes as if there's something fishy. You see, you see, it treasure. If the treasure is not taped about this one, keep on saying one, keep on saying two. Really, I do support the treasure. Because at a glance, you feel witty. Things were not done properly. And starting with the planning, buying such an old vessel, immediately trying to do away with it, you know. Yeah, that's why my interest was taken in to say, I don't know whether I'm right if I'm saying this vessel was sold at 50,000 because the fuel was 250,000. It was just sold at 50,000, having been bought at 500 million. At 5 million. So the treasury serious on this one should be.
Machama.
Thank you. Yeah, I also feel comforted by the steps that have been taken to improve the financial accounting of the Marine Living Resources Fund. Just one aspect of it that Mr. Mohammed mentioned was that there just still isn't enough accounting capacity, and with particular regard to the assets of MCM, and I'd just like to know what steps are being taken to address that. I'd also like to just absolutely agree with Honourable Morgan about, in a general way, how can one maximise the importance of our coastline as far as this government is concerned? How can our portfolio committee assist in bringing it into a greater position of importance, not only environmentally, but as an absolute financial asset, because it is one of the most remarkable coastlines in the world. I mean, I fly over it very regularly between PE and Cape Town, and I'm always trying to sit on the coastline side, and I absolutely boggle at the beauty of it. And it is just an extraordinary asset. And I'm not sure that our current government, is taking it seriously enough. And then I'd also like to ask about recovered abalone. I know when you pull it out of the water, there's not an awful lot that can be done with it if the poachers are apprehended. But there must still be an awful lot of frozen abalone and dried abalone that is also confiscated, and I know it's supposed to go to auction. I'd just like to see where that fits in terms of an asset. I'd also like to ask, in agreement with Honourable Morgan, what does it cost? What would it cost to protect our coastline appropriately? then something that was quite a substantial financial revenue some years ago was our that we it got from foreign fishermen in our waters, from foreign fishing countries, which was stopped. But now, what is going on with tuna? Because we don't have the capacity to fish tuna in our waters. That is my understanding. And I believe that there's going to be another agreement made, I could be wrong, with foreign countries as far as our tuna stocks are concerned. And I mean, tuna now on the Japanese market is the most extraordinary price. I mean, it runs into hundreds and hundreds, millions of dollars. Yeah, I think mostly I have been covered by previous questions. I'd also like to know, because I know along the PE and around their coastline, there are many, many folk who live on the sea, and they would be very happy, but just are not quite sure what the route is to become honorary fishing officers, and not quite sure what teeth they do have. Who should they contact, and what teeth would they have if they did? Because they could be a huge asset as far as patrolling the coastline is concerned. Thank you, Chair.
Before I knock you in, Datem Kwena, I would like to hear your comments on transformation in the fishing industry. There's been a huge problem, particularly in the East London area, in terms of the fishing quotas, in terms of fronting. The chairperson and myself went out there. We met quite a number of stakeholders who told us what their problems were in relation to fronting, which is very prevalent in that area. And one other thing relates to people who would be working for companies at sea, but a lot of the labor laws were violated. I would like to know if it has been brought to your attention, and if so, what have you done about that situation? Now, I also would like to hear what your comments are in relation to trying to deal with abalone poaching. That's one of the biggest problems that we are having. Now, have you, or would you entertain an idea of trying to have an indaba with the poachers? But the actual objective of that would be to see if you could transform them into buying into a program where they could be part of abalone fishing in its natural habitat, because they dive in those areas and they are able to catch this abalone from those areas. But if you could come up with a program where you would have a cooperative, which is a community thing, where they would also be part of that, and as a result, there would be no need for them to become poachers, but be part of that operation. You know, if you do have some interest, we had a presentation at one stage from a gentleman who seemed to have a program of that kind into a handling. So I would like to know whether would you be interested in something like that, because to me it would appear as though if you can convert those people who are not law-abiding citizens into becoming law-abiding citizens, then perhaps that particular industry could be developed into something more substantial, which would also benefit the communities as well. And there, I would like to hear your comments on that. Ntate Mgwen, thank you.
Yes. Listen, with the graces of amusement, is what we say to Chairperson to your suggestion. It's like having a number of the cash in transit heist robbers. and encouraging them to open bank accounts.
No, that's slightly different than the
question. I know. I think it's suspicious. Okay, second question. I didn't want to come up with this question for either one, because I wanted to zero in on the English staff. But I think my colleagues have asked a number of questions, which are very good indeed, Sarah Going, which are going to assist them here. Let me now come up with a more general, come up with a more general approach to MCM. Right. We had an Indaba a workshop 2 years ago, where everyone was presenting all the different branches. An idea came up very strongly. Some of us felt very strongly about it. You see, MCM, I asked a very penetrating question, and then Mr. Jason, he answered me very honestly. I said, we have what the Marine River Resources Fund, we have what MCM. If you disembowel, if you take out the MLRF, can you still talk about the MCM? And she says, no, definitely not. Which means MCM, MCM is just it's a cloud. It is nothing without the MLR. Right. Now that means that now you've got two entities. You've got an umbrella thing called MCM, you've got MLR. And MLRF, as the Honorable Morgan has said, operates on the basis of perverse incentives. Now, if you remove that, it means there's no MCM. What is MCM? MCM says nothing. Now, why is MCM nothing? It's because, historically, MCM has been bought from here in the Western Cape. And previously, then there was the perverse incentives, unions in the operating. Yeah, people in Kensington, Devon, and the port there, doing their own thing there, not accountable to the Western Cape based thing. We have the people in the PE Eastern Cape doing their own thing there. So you have got no coastal jurisdictional authority. You don't have that. And we've got the DDG here, Dr. Mike, an excellent fellow, doing wonderful work with Mr. Shea and other people, etc. But then they are not recognized by their subordinates in PE and Devon. Now, what you must do now, and I'm coming up with yesterday, you need to have a coastal governmental authority. MCM must be a coastal governmental authority. We need to have a workshop where we as a portfolio committee call and some the MCM people in KZN, in the Eastern Cape, in PE and PE in Islam, come here. Each one of them, there must be questionnaires. We must answer. We are calling here for as part of our oversight. We want to know exactly what your common account. The people in the kitchen must say, we are a little MCF here. This is how we operate. This is how many people we have, etc. And then we have a whole questionnaire. If that is going to be a general questionnaire, that's going to go to the Eastern Cape people and also Western Cape people there. The purpose of this thing is to weave a tapestry of governance for the MCF. That's the first exercise. The second exercise, we must then say, do we actually need to have MLRF existing as a punitive traffic cop operating entity? Or should it be sucked into the belly of MCM itself? And with its functions, spread out within MCM without it existing as a little traffic cop division within MCM? So I'm looking at the corporate governance strategy in order to be able to deal with all these management problems. Because you see, if we zero in on little assets there, Ingestan, so, we shall forever the control committee be wearing binoculars to look at this little insect, that, forever and ever then. And a lot of delinquency will be taking place in the entire area. So that is now, I'm looking for a holistic approach to doing this thing. Because you have Sandy, as in dealing with everything, you've got Sandpans, you've got tourism, and then over the quality thing, it's a different program. So all other things are properly packaged. But when it comes to MCA, it is not properly packaged. it's supposed to be a horse, but at the moment now it is a camel. If somebody says, what is the definition of a camel? A camel is an animal that was designed by a committee. You see? So, now, that's the first point. The second point is that of being me. I share your view, acting chairperson quickly, about the BE story, the Francis thing. Well, here, your presentation pack talks about 59% of the beneficiaries. Very impressive. But when we went to a workshop in East London, we heard horrific stories of Francis. They were so blatant, it was just unbelievable. A lot of people cast in on this new dispensation of right allocation, et cetera, and, you know, using, you know, typical African names there, you know, Masisanani, fisheries, this and that and that, and first level things such as, you know, Masakane, et cetera, that now. So, gullibly, the officials in MCM, when they looked at the black name, they said, gee, no, this must definitely be perfect, you know. And that's actually what happened. And most of the people there actually said in the fishing quarters, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and we know the horror story. People can put them more eloquently than some of us can. But the point is this, that this 59% should actually be unpacked. And it can only be unpacked through the instrumentality of the law that is part of the policy. And an audit is going to come, engineered by U.S. Department, to say, PwC, well, here are the people who were allocated fishing rights. Let's find out how many of them have ever complied. That is where the fronting is going to be exposed. Because fortunately, we did say that now. In this position, allocations are going to be made, but that's not the end of the story. We're still going to come back to where binoculars and insurance. Look at every fronting now. How many of the big boys, big girls have complied? And how many of the black guys, you know, have actually become delinquent by encouraging corruption in this fund. Some of the fund is intentional, and some of it is helpless, but there's also the one that actually intentional. I just want to make a quick buck. I want to get in the taxi industry. The quick way is get a fishing guy who has a black face, and what the regulator is going to be very, very sympathetic. Give me this, but I do not want to become a fisher folk. My idea is actually to go and drive a taxi. But it's a long route to go and get my daddy through a West Bank, bank fee and aesthetic. I'll use the cheap route of fishing because the government feels blackmailed in my economy. They think I'm a genuine fisher cook in the fisheries field, but I actually don't want to become a taxi driver. So that is on this one. Yeah, and I think I must really stop there. And of course, this links up with the first question of the mission and vision.
I thought you said you were stopping there.
Yeah. If the mission and vision currently instructs, because it's the mission and vision of MLRF as it stands now, but we want to change this, we want to change completely, transform completely. Transformation here is very broad. It's not only about pigmentation. It is also about the fact that the entire entity, you have to be restructured, you know, in the area of financial services. That will then have the effect of impacting on the vision and mission of the MLRF.
Perhaps before you could respond, let me take Manvanga, and that really would be the last round of our questions. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Chair, I think this question about the EcoStar has to be dealt with, and our minds must be set at ease. Because I say so because there have been DDGs before this, the question of this came up, this 5 million vessel came up, and nothing was done. All those other DDGs did nothing about this. And it is only when the last the DDG came up that questions had to be asked about this vessel. And a lot of things came up about what is in it,
that money must come out so that people must, some experts must go in and see and look at that and about what is going to happen. But now, why didn't this government has only been in power for about 10 years, I think. But now the vessel has been there for ages. What has this vessel been doing that now, at this moment, now that there's a new government, someone doesn't want to get rid of this vessel, They still want to keep on to it and keep on bringing in an excuse and excuse so that our government must be held as being corrupt by other countries. Can we know? Can we get the fact about this? Can we our minds be made to rest about this? Because otherwise, next year, in 2 years' time, she'll be gone, and because of such things. And we need to retain our DGs here so that we should know that. When you questioned them last year, you said this to me, and this year I want to know if that has been done. Now, what are we going to ask about? Well, because our former DG is not here, and the other DGs never reported anything about this. Please, Chairperson, let us get the clarity on this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's the host of comments, questions, what have you, and so forth. So we are all ears. Thank you.
Okay, then Chair, I would request that Dr. Maeke some of that and followed by Andra to deal with some of the questions around the resources, the tuna, the abalone, and then Mr. Salim, Mohammed, and then I'll talk at the end.
Thank you, Chair. I will start with the questions that were asked by Honorable Mugwema. Who handled the, and Salim will deal with the insurance part of the question, who handled the matter? This matter was handled by myself as well as the then CFO, Abdullah, and what we were doing had the approval of the Chair. At the beginning of my submission, I said that a number of factors combined to cause us to get an outcome that all of us didn't want. It is easy to be wise with hindsight and say maybe we should have done it this way instead of that way. The fact of the matter is that the department doesn't manage its vessels. The vessels are managed by Smith & Hamner, who are a shipping company. And when they advised us, they said, do not have a reserve price for this auction. First of all, they advised us on an auction. Secondly, they advised us that do not have a reserve price, because if you have a reserve price, it tends to discourage people from coming to the auction. It is possible that maybe the right decision would have been to have a reserve price. But we didn't know at the time that there would be a cancellation of the first auction so that the final auction be carried out post the fishing rights allocation. So the issue of a reserve price, Chair, was considered, and the advice we got was that don't go for a reserve price.
Let's give them an opportunity to respond to our questions and comments. Thank you.
Yes, and you know, at the time, we thought it was the right decision. Then, Honorable Morgan asked questions around cost recovery, and it's difficult to answer his question. We agree that the ocean management in our country, Paris, is not what it should be. It is very, very fragmented. Department of Health has something to do with the ocean. Science and technology has something to do with the ocean. Transport has something to do with the ocean. And all these are housed in different government departments. Other countries, such as Australia, have a central secretariat that causes an integration of ocean matters right across government. Canada has a Department of Ocean. So anything that has got to do with ocean is discussed in that, is handled in that, in that central department. There's a sense, Honorable Mokoena, in which DIPT may be unfortunate in that it is the only institution in South Africa that has research vessels. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
It is the only institution that has research vessels. So if people at UCT have got to do ocean research, they've got to be accommodated in some way in our vessels. And historically, we haven't made them pay. But if we were, it would impact quite negatively on teaching of marine science in the country. So yes, Honorable Mokoena, a thinking we need to apply our minds as to how the oceans are managed going forward. Then if I go back to Honorable Morgan, cost recovery, yes, we have, our view is that a cost recovery is not the way to go because of the difficulty in measuring the value of the ocean, the value of the coastal zone. But I must say that we have not conducted a study that measures accurately how much it would cost to do X, Y, Z. Because it's difficult to determine X, Y, Z. What is it that you need to do to make sure that abalone is not caught illegally? It's not very easy to arrive at a figure because you have to say, we are interested in them not getting the fish out of the water. So if you want to make sure fish doesn't get out of the water, does it mean you must have a fishery control officer for each two kilometers of the coastline? We've got a 3,000 coastline. So it is difficult. I think we would always have to work from the basis of what we have and say by what amount we need to increase what we have. We have now 219 fishery control officers. I think we would need to say, well, if they are distributed maybe one in 50 kilometers, maybe we say we aim in the next 2 years to have two of them in a 50 kilometer zone. But to get an absolute number, I suspect would be difficult. Not that we haven't made any attempts toward understanding the concept. We did a year and a half ago commission a study by the World Bank, but that study was aimed at telling us what the value of the fishery is. But we need to move beyond that and conduct a study that says, well, that's the value of the fishery. What is the value of protecting it? So I'm afraid that has not yet been done. I want to promise Honorable Mokoena that, Honorable Morgan, that we would prefer the abalone to be in the water. We would never be proud of our operations having to depend on it. We don't feel good about it, let me put it that way. So where we can avoid it, if we would like to avoid it altogether. And can I add the fact that effectively the fishery is now closed. So in a short space of time, it would be expected that we wouldn't catch any fish if we control poaching. We have developed a close working relationship with the South African Police Services, and I went to a meeting with them last week, and they insist, and we're heartened by that, that the important thing, Chair, is to keep the abalone in the water rather than catching people in Beaufort West with dead abalone. And I must say to the committee that the cooperation that we've got from South African Police Services on since the closure of abalone fishery has been impressive. Then there was the question on what the focus is for fisheries resources and what sort of strategic view that we take into managing them. Chair, I am reminded of the fact that our most important resource, hake, and I'll use it as an example. Most important resource, which is hake, contributes more than 50% of the revenue from the fisheries. Today, we're catching in one of the species 10 times less than we caught 50 years ago. That's a reality we have. And if I look at West Coast rock lobster, 50 years ago we were catching 10,000, we're now catching 2,000. So we're catching five times less than we caught 50 years ago. What then do you do under those circumstances? You try as much as you can to employ a rebuilding strategy towards the resources and hope that you will not get negative environmental impact. And your conservative fishing strategy, your rebuilding strategy involves setting relatively conservative TAC so that we can begin to see a recovery in the stock. Chair, to complicate matters, of course, we are now discovering that the way we manage, which is managing a single species, you're managing for rock lobster, you're managing hake, is in fact the wrong way to do it. That these animals do not exist in isolation. They exist in an environment. And therefore the best way to go is to go the way of your ecosystem approach to fisheries. I'm just indicating, Honorable Morgan, where we're going with fisheries management. In the future, we should move more towards looking at the whole ecosystem, which we're doing quite successfully together with Angola and Namibia, looking at the whole ecosystem and protecting the system as a whole. And that way, we are better, we're in a better position to protect the resources and stop what we see happening now from 50 years ago. Confiscated equipment, yes, we do get confiscated equipment, and we do use some of that confiscated equipment ourselves. But, Chair, it is fair to say the way we've worked with SAPS on that matter needs improvement. There's just not absolute clarity on what goes where. And we are going to, we've got two legal people that are attached to our MCS division who we've charged with tracking all the assets that get confiscated to make sure that they come and provide finance to the MLRF. Then there was the question of the honorary fishery control officer. That chair is a concept that we are interested in. I'm advised we've got about 100 of them that are working with us. But of course, there are dangers, because there's a member of the public that you're giving an authority as a law enforcer. We've had bad experiences. We also have good experiences. So it is something that we will patch you going forward and try to take the necessary care so that we do not have honorary officers that are going to do things that are going to embarrass. But it's a concept that we view favorably, and in fact, in some of the cases now, you never know what to say and what not to say. In some cases, we're looking at engaging also police reservists, who are people who already have had some training in law enforcement. We're looking at all those options. Mantuli, Honorable Mantuli, I think I've covered your question, even if you are not happy with the answer. But I could just add something that I see in this report in front of me. With vessels, unlike motor cars, there's no market value for a vessel. There is no market value for a vessel. They will tell you with cars that the market value of that car is 20,000. But with vessels, the market value is what you fetch on the day on which you auction. If there are many people that are interested in a vessel and they've got use for it, the price will rise. If there are few people and there's limited interest in the vessel, the price will be low. That unfortunately is the nature of this beast. The vessel, again, Chair, the vessel was not bought new by the state. The vessel was confiscated from a fishing company. So as a fishing vessel, it had to be modified and be provided additional equipment, because it was now going to be used by law enforcers. There are more stringent conditions attached to a vessel like that one compared to a fishing vessel. So yes, the department spent money in equipping the vessel so that it could be used as a training vessel rather than a fishing vessel. Useful life of a vessel. The Agalas, for an example, we are replacing now, it is 30 years. We have been advised that the useful life of a vessel that will go into the Southern Ocean is no more than 30 years. So for that kind of vessel is 30 years. With fishing vessels, it is possible I've seen 35-year-old fishing vessels. But it is important to emphasize that was not the kind of vessel that the department wanted, now that a decision had already been taken to purchase four modern vessels. Recall, Chair, some of the older vessels were limited to work around the coast. They couldn't go to Prince Edward Island. They couldn't go anywhere offshore. So it was important to procure new vessels which would, one, do what was required, two, which would be nimble. The difference between a patrol vessel and a research vessel, there's a difference. The patrol vessel has to be nimble, has to be quick in order to apprehend the poachers. Research vessel has got to be more steady in the water. So the old 37 or 33-year-old vessel could not be effectively used today to apprehend poachers. So it was necessary to replace that vessel. Then there was a question, Honorable Manjuli, about the planning. Again, I don't know if I'm wrong, but the planning for this vessel was done a long time ago. It was done around 1997. And the vessels were commissioned in 2004. What may not have been properly planned for was the rise of the cost of fuel. So once we got all four vessels, we discovered they cost a fortune to run. And that is one thing that may not have been anticipated with accuracy. It is causing the rise in the cost of the fuel. Honorable Chalmers, last year our major weakness was around law enforcement, and we were successful in persuading Treasury to give us additional resources for enforcement for the next 3 years. What we have in our plans now, because we've discovered that the weakness is not only with control, in other words, controlling poaching, but we have got another leg of our work that also needs attention, which is your research. Now, our research vessels cannot go and spend enough time out at sea, then our understanding of what is out in the ocean will be limited, and therefore decision making will be poor.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like the committee chair perhaps to assist us on this focus for this year, which is to make sure that we adequately fund it for research purposes. I'm just reminded that if we let our research equipment erode, it will be very, very difficult to then pick it up again, so that we will get in the credible information. Andre, I will let Andre ask Andre to answer the tuna question. My understanding, we do not have any foreign fishing in South African waters except as joint vendors in this fishery. Can you explain that, Andre?
Thank you, Chair. As the honourable members are aware, that the large pelagic fishery, which includes the tuna and the swordfish, this is a high seas fishery, not within our 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. And it is also managed on the west coast through the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, of which I represent South Africa at this commission, and was also elected vice chair of this commission last year. That is where we then negotiate quotas within the international waters. Now, this is a fishery that hasn't really taken off as we wanted it to. And Honorable Chalmers is absolutely correct that there is not enough technical know-how within South Africa to exploit this fish resources on the high seas, let alone have the necessary capacity in terms of the infrastructure, in terms of vessels, to venture out so far beyond the 200 nautical mile zone. Now, currently within this fishery, we have about 13 foreign fishing vessels, 8 from Japan, 2 from the Philippines, and 3 from Korea. Now, the right holders are still South African. They then enter into joint ventures with foreign partners. We then require that they follow a South Africanization program in terms of reflagging the vessel back to South Africa over a period of time, and then also try and reskill South African crew within a certain period of time, because we were also concerned that the crew may stay foreign, and we want to provide the necessary job opportunities to our own nationals. This fishery was not fully allocated. There were about 30 tuna rights available and 20 in swordfish. We have published a draft policy to allocate the additional total allowable effort within the fishery, and by September this year we would have then allocated the additional tuna and swordfish rights, because the more we can improve our catch performance on the high seas, that then provides the leverage to negotiate for more quantum on the high seas at the International Commission. Thank you.
Thanks, Andre. Then there were questions from the Chair and Honorable Mukwena on transformation and funding. Difficult question to deal with, Chair. I see fronting as falling into two categories. The first category is where you pretend to be what you are not, and then get a name that sounds like you're doing that. Then the other kind of fronting is where you become and look like a legitimate director of a company, whereas you're a token director of company. Now, Chair, the allocation process that we engaged in 2005 went a long way in trying to establish who had a beneficial interest in all the applicants. We demanded that all data that is given to us by the company be certified by an auditor. Auditors signed off to say what we were told is incorrect. It is correct, sorry. The intention, and one of Mukwena is correct, the intention was always that after 2 years, we will go and check, which we will do, go and check whether people told us the truth and whether they stayed true to what they had claimed in their application form. Mm-hmm. So we will then get to identify who is genuine or who is not genuine. But Chair, I do want to say that it is not an easy matter, because what we are beginning to hear now from the industry, people say, well, my allocation was never big enough, and now you're reducing the quota, you're making this thing unviable. Now you can't expect me to do X, Y, Z. That is the kind of thing that we anticipate we're going to have to confront and deal with. The issue I want to guess, Chair, but we're talking about squid fishery here, where the employers are tend to take advantage of the fishers in those vessels. And that matter was considered by our minister, and our minister did meet with the Minister of Labour on the matter of getting the legislation to somewhat cover the fishers. So it is a matter our department and Department of Labour have been looking at. But I didn't anticipate the question, so I didn't check before coming here where that story is. And then, Chair, you proposed that we could have a co-management arrangement with people, some of whom could have been poachers. Those are all concepts that were considered in the past, but at this time, the fishery is closed. So we couldn't do it. Then, Honorable Mukwena, the the issue of restructuring the MLRF arrangement, maybe I should leave that to the acting DG to handle. But I, as in the past, I have admitted in this committee chair that because we have only 219 inspectors in our organization, which is not provincial but actually national, except that most of the fishing occurs here, which is why we based it in Cape Town. But in fact, we're not provincial department but a national department. We just located here because 80% of the commercial fishing happens here. But you're right, we should be giving more, we should be more visible in the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal. KwaZulu-Natal has more recreational fishing than the Western Cape, and recreational fishing is less important than commercial fishing. So yes, we need to. But the problem has always been that KwaZulu-Natal has had the capacity to enforce regulation in that part of the world, and we pay them for doing it. But we just perhaps need to manage the contract a little better than before. Similarly in the Eastern Cape, the groups that enforce the Marine Living Resources Act are doing it on our behalf. So yes, maybe we do need.
Just as a contract, with MCM. How do you have the contract within MCM?
Okay.
Then there was a question of
transformation and the 59%. I don't want to dwell on that, Chair, except to say the figures, of course, vary depending on the fishery. If you look at a fishery like South Coast Rock Lobster, you will find that the transformation level there is about 74%. But if you look at a very capital-intensive fishery like hake, the level is 27%. So what we've done is just to do an average of all those figures, and we arrive at 59%. But you're right, one needs to look at it more carefully. It's not general. The 59% is not general to the fishery. Then, lastly, Honorable Mandanga, I think we all the time need to just be careful and make sure that we adhere to principles of government all the time. And I think as the acting DG indicated, we're always trying to improve so that what we didn't do correctly, then we do it better in future. For an example, I mean, we never used to have a disposal committee before. We now have a disposal committee which will then interrogate all decisions that have to do with disposal of off government assets. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Just one question.
Yes.
You were telling me about the going to talk to some of the financial questions.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, without trying to repeat what Dr. Maikiso has indicated already, I wanted to talk about the billing in advance that Honourable Morgan has indicated. We started last year with developing a fish and fish product levy bill. And in this levy bill, which obviously needs to be brought to Parliament by the department, by National Treasury, because it's a levy bill. So our department can't bring it to Parliament. And unfortunately, I say very unfortunately, it wasn't on the roll this time around, and to my disappointment, my grave disappointment, because the right way of managing it would be surrounding having an upfront data that we put into our system and then trying to recover that debt. But in the levies bill, we've got a memorandum of objects, and that was thoroughly processed in terms of international accounting standards and what is allowable, and also taking in consideration the fishing industry. So we'll have categories, much the same like SARS have for perhaps a small business. If you getting a turnover under 5 million rand, you pay less tax, business tax. So similarly, we would recognize that small rights holders with a less of a TAC would have a scale, and the Minister of Environmental Affairs would have that ability to set that scale in this fish and fish product levies board. They'd also have payment plans that we built in, the ability to derive payment plans for debtors. So it wouldn't have be a case of where we expect you to suddenly pay everything up front, and that would have grave impact on your cash flow. We understand that obviously people catch as the season goes on. In some industries, in some sectors, they catch up front immediately within 2 weeks. I know with regards to the abalone closure, the 75 tons you were talking about, there was lots of talk in with industry that they'll be able to catch it within a month, for instance. So that type of situations will be taken into consideration in terms of the various fisheries. But as I told you before, of course, now it wasn't put on the Parliament roll yet, so I'm expecting it only to come through towards next year. So we're still on the Sea Fisheries Act, the outdated Sea Fisheries Act in terms of how we're collecting revenue, which is on the cash basis after the fact happened, which is a bit unfortunate, making our debtors management a bit difficult, but... we can try our best to, of course, try and ensure accuracy and validity. With regards to the cost recovery system, Dr. Maikiso did outline processes, but I just wanted to make a comment. During the whole study, there was this extra part of it that we did, which was actually doing calculations on what it cost MCN in terms of operational costs and what the research part cost, and what we consider as public good, because there's various jobs being done within MCM, for instance in integrated coastal management, which doesn't affect the industry at all, but has an indirect effect to the industry because you're working on the coastline. Those were considered public good, and when we deliberated with National Treasury, they understood and accepted that they have a responsibility to pay for those items. And the percentage that we came up with, in fact, was quite high for public good initiatives. 70% of, close to 70% of the work that's done can be considered public good. Now, that's easy to define when you look at our vessel operating costs. Who should pay for vessel operating costs? That is a public good because it's monitoring and control of our whole coastline as such. Not only specifically for the fishing industry, but for all South Africans as a whole. And if you look at our financial statements, you'll notice that vessel operating cost was 130 million rand in 0607, out of about 280 million rand. That's almost 50% of our expenditure. So, of course, there's a level of responsibility that National Treasury has to take with regards to transferring money to us, and we appeal to this committee to once again support us when we go to requesting more money. They have shown that level of responsibility in the 07-08 year by transferring 79 million rand specifically to vessel operating costs. I did give some facts of our surplus and our deficit from 05-06 we had a deficit, 06-07 we had a surplus. That has got a lot to do with the fact that we sold quite a lot of confiscated abalone. So we're in the process of looking at the transfer 06-07 was 79 million. That moved up from 25 million. So you can see a tangible commitment by National Treasury recognizing that public good needs to be financed by them.
What worries me is that movement of funds escaped the portfolio committee. So how was it approved? How could we just go to the central treasury, we need so much, and just say, oh no, public good, here's the money. Because we want to come in parliament and ratify those transfers. That's how we got the supplemental budget. So that's an irregularity. You can't just go as functional as the treasury and say, some more, please. Gravy. It's only one needs some more gruel. You can't do that. You must come to parliament.
It did, but acting visual. Cover the process. So as I was saying, honourable members, we've obviously recognized that there's a difficulty in trying to get more revenue streams into the fund, but the main revenue stream would then be from MTEF funds. At the moment, for the current financial year, as I said, the 08-09 year, we're looking at a 319 million rand budget. Of that 319 million rand budget, 186 million rand would come via MTEF funding, and the rest would be own revenue. Obviously, you can imagine that it is extremely difficult exercise to try and predict what poaching is going to be and how much we're going to get from confiscated products. In fact, that's a very, very difficult one that we lost with. And as Dr. Mikey so indicated before, it saddens us when that happens. Of course, I've got the director of revenue management in my team, and of course, one would often say that the director, revenue manager, would be smiling at the fact that we're going more poaching, but even he has been turned around now to realize that it's having a grave effect on our abalone fishery. Thank you very much.
All right. Lastly, Chair and Honourable Members, I'll just add, because my colleagues have already provided most of the answers, but just to deal with the question Honourable Mukwena asked about the MCM and the issue of roles and jurisdiction. Let me just remind you members that the marine resources management is an exclusive national competence. We don't share that with the province. It's not necessarily a responsibility of provinces. But then by cooperation, we then have these memorandum of agreements. Hence, Dr. Mayegis was talking about the contracts with KZN or KZN Wildlife and so on and so on. We give them money to do work on our behalf in terms of the fisheries management function. However, coastal zone management is a concurrent function, which is why we've now developed the legislation, which is the Integrated Coastal Management Zone Bill, which deals with how then we work cooperatively with the provinces and the municipal spheres of government. And again, there are clear roles and responsibilities and how we then coordinate across the spheres so as to take probably more of the concerns that the Honourable Mukwena had raised. So in a sense, I think that is more the understanding in terms of exactly what we are responsible for as a national department. And then the issue of the MRLF. MRLF then is then based, is there as a fund that emanates from the provisions of the Act that establishes this, which is the Marine Living Resources Act, as I indicated earlier on in my presentation. And in essence, if the MRLF would just focus on the fisheries function and leave the coastal zone functions, the department would have to deal with those integrated coastal zone management issues. Which is why also in terms of the cost recovery framework and the issues that were raised by the Honorable Morgan in his absence, is that we cannot bill the fishing industry for those kind of activities. Because those that relate to the whole integrity of the coastal zone, not just related to the fishing business, which is why we have to be clear, because constitutionally they can also challenge us if we charge them for things that they are not supposed to be paying for. Hence, then, the impracticality of the cost recovery framework being able to work in this regard. And maybe, again, in the absence of the Honourable Morgan, the issues around the cost our function in the whole of the coastal zone, if we were to maintain a sustainable coastal zone, including its fisheries or the various resources that we find in the ocean, we would have to really have Dr. Maxwell was saying we have a 3,000 kilometer coast. At least we have one person per kilometer, I would think, and we can calculate that those are enormous costs.
we have to have surveillance and real-time capability, so we have to implement the whole technology frame, and which we are wanting to do, but it's not affordable at this point in time. And over and above that, have the patrol vessels, which are already taking a lot of money from our budget, but it's necessary activities. So I am sure we would not spend less than even 700,000 million per annum if we were to do all of that footstool. And I would not think that as government probably cannot quite afford that. But I think Treasury, the whole process of cost recovery, when we're engaging, because this is the work that MLF and the department has been doing with Treasury, they've understood that we have to depend quite highly on the subsidy of a government coming from the National Treasury, and that is something that we would then always factor in our submissions to Treasury. And coming to the issue around increasing budgets, Honorable Mukwena, the budgeting cycle as officials and government, it starts around June, July, and Treasury gives us particular instructions on things that we must submit, motivations and so on and so on. And then they have a MINCOM budget, and we come to you when we present our strategic plan on priorities. And we also factor in what they've given us as the baseline. And therefore, as Parliament, you also approve those allocations in a sense. So when we were briefing you last week on the SWEP plan, we had already factored in these transfers and the allocation that we're getting from Treasury for the MRLF, and which is something that you have to then approve when we table the SWEP plan officially before the Minister's Budget vote in May. And then lastly, maybe Mantuli, about the planning for vessels. You are right that we have to plan. Definitely in this case, the planning was done. It was not an overnight thing that we're going to have four new vessels. It's been something that we've had money from Treasury since 2002 and building up till then, when we were in a position to even get rid of the Eagle Star, because it did not have any real purpose to serve. And I think, honourable members, I would want to appeal to you to your understanding of decision making and outcomes. I think as a department, and the MRLF particularly, we take responsibility for the decisions that were made in respect of disposing the Eagle Star. And we even said, because it's costing us every day, even if it meant that we only get 100,000, it's normal in government that when you buy a computer, all the computers that we buy, when they come to the office and they leave the factory, they've already depreciated in value. And when we sell them, some of them, we sell them with 100,000 rand, or not 100,000, just 100 rand. They are things that we've disposed as the state at a lower a cost as that, which is why it was not for us abnormal to get the kind of money that we got even on Eagle Star, because just in 3 months it had cost us 500,000 just on maintaining it without using it. So those decisions that were made, and when the DG approved the process, there was nothing untoward in terms of what we got from the auction. We just thought that, well, it means we sold it at not necessarily at the right time, as we acknowledge, but even if we were to keep it, Treasury or the Auditor General, we would have had to declare the wasteful expenditure, because to keep it for the whole year, we're going to incur more than 1 million, and it was still going to be wasteful expenditure. So I think in the real weighing of probabilities, I think that it was still a good decision for us to accept what we got from that auction, and we are not blaming anybody, which is why in terms of our own investigations we have not found anything quite untoward. Even if we were to bring back that chief financial officer and question him, it is not something that's completely out of power with the practice in general
Vessels are complicated things, we understand, and we rely on advices from technical people that work with vessels. And we took the advice and we had an opportunity to make a decision, and the decision was made, which is what then led to what was achieved out of the sale. So we want to reemphasize that the qualification that we got in this annual report in respect of the Eagle Star is not about the decisions that we made. It's more that we did not declare the 500,000 that was wasted. After we kept the vessel, when we cancelled the first option, we had about 3 months where we incurred another 500,000, and also we had other cancellation fees of about 30-something thousand. And what was the amount?
Matters of government.
Yeah, which was around 39,261. That was also wasteful. So that's wasteful expenditure. That's what the qualification is all about. The decisions were made, and there was a paper trail on the decisions that were made.
I think that we have exhausted all the responses, and that really brings us to the end of our session. And thank you very much.
Just around the corvettes, the current vessels in use, are you finding that they are worthwhile? The corvettes, the current corvettes, I mean, are they paying their way? Or, I mean, it's difficult because there's such a perception around their usage, but do you find that they are really being useful, that they are you able to rent them out to other foreign states? I mean, are they proving that they were worth the huge amount of money that was invested in them? Just a brief answer, if that's possible.
Thank you, Chair. Corvette, what are we talking about? Are we talking about...
We have four patrol vessels. The three that operate more inshore and the one that goes offshore. We think that they are doing a sterling job. We know what happens in the Port Elizabeth area when one of the red ladies arrives. We know what happens around Robben Island when one of the red ladies but Chair, compliance or enforcement is also about being visibly present. So the fishing companies know that any minute a vessel will appear and we say, we want to see your permit. We want to see what you're catching. We want to examine your equipment, which thing we couldn't do without the vessel. And also the vessels would have a preventive impact, which is difficult to measure. But we prevented this by having the vessel. But we are comfortable that the vessels are providing real value to our operation center.
But I think the expensive part, I mean, we could rent them out, but I don't think that in terms of the time that we need them at sea, it would be quite viable to rent them out. Rather, we want more money to be able to run them and have more of the presence of those vessels, because the issue is how many sea days can we have based on the money or the budget that we have. Similarly with research, the reason why we don't carry our research program as we would have liked to is because we've got limited funds for the crews that are supposed to go out and do the research outside of the routine
sampling, but we need to do more even around our work that would contribute to impacts and plans for climate change mitigation activities. So it is quite something that we think they are expensive, but we think that they serve a very good cause.
Thank you. I then declare the meeting closed.